Europe is experiencing the largest wave of refugees since World War II and is desperate to find a long-term solution. Join America Abroad for a town hall discussion linking New York to Berlin on iTunes and PRI.org/AmericaAbroad.
Russia says it didn't dope. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The World Anti-Doping Agency accuses Russia of widespread doping among its track and field athletes, but a Russian official calls the charges
baseless, pure fiction. He questioned the objectivity of the report's authors and said it was just largely part of a trend aimed at kind of denigrating Russia's athletes and the country as a whole.
Also, President Obama's immigration plan suffers a legal setback, leaving this woman's mother in limbo.
She still doesn't know what day she'll be able to go back to Mexico and hug her mother while being able to come back home.
Plus, thieves in France make off with thousands of dollars worth of cheese.
Actually, it makes sense. Cheese does cost a lot of money.
The great French cheese heist of 2015, today on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Glad you can make it here today. So, an international investigation uncovers evidence of Russian deception. The Russians deny everything. We've heard that a few times lately. I'm thinking about Ukraine, mostly. But the story we're kicking off with today on The World is about something completely different: cheating in sports. A report by the World Anti-Doping Agency accuses Russia of running a state-sponsored doping program. This includes both doping track and field athletes and covering up the positive tests. Some of those athletes could now be banned from the next Olympics. Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow says a whole host of Russian officials are denouncing the report.
I guess you could start at the top. Let's start with President Putin's press spokesman. His official spokesman said that the charges appear to be unfounded. These are accusations, but there's no proof. You can move then down to the Russian Minister of Sport, Vitaly Mutko, who also agreed with that. He said that some of these findings, of course, were expected. They know they have some problems and some work to do. But all largely said that the report was baseless, pure fiction. He questioned the objectivity of the report's authors and said it was just largely part of a trend aimed at kind of denigrating Russia's athletes and the country as a whole.
You know, the brazenness of some of the allegations against the Russians is pretty shocking. You can't help but think of the old Soviet programs that, you know, used any number of chemicals to boost performance. Some scary Frankenstein stuff at one point in the Soviet years.
That's right. I mean, I think that's definitely part of that trend. But there's also a sense of, you know, I think a lot of Russians today look at this in the current context of, look, we've been so successful now in the sporting world. And I'm sure you, as someone from New England watching the Patriots, could kind of feel that. There's a bit of this sort of hate us because you ain't us kind of thing going on here.
We're talking track and field athletes here. Any of the accused speaking out?
At this point, no. I mean, we've seen some athletes who were former Olympic champions. There's kind of a trend in Russia where a lot of Olympians then go on into the Russian Duma. So, for example, you have people that are on very high committees and various sports committees in the Russian Duma who've come out against this as well, saying that at the very least, we have no proof of these accusations. It's been kind of the same line of thinking, but I think it's very much in tune with how sort of closely aligned politics and sport are in this country.
This all comes at a time when Russia is fighting a war in Syria, still dealing with sanctions over its war in Ukraine, and now this damaging report to its sporting reputation. How's Putin handling this?
Well, Putin hasn't said anything officially. He's actually down in Sochi at this moment. He met with basically heads of various sporting federations here in Russia to talk about preparations for the Rio Games. And I imagine they probably got around to talking about this report as well. But he hasn't made any public statements. But I think generally there's this sense, of course, that Russia is somehow being maligned in various fields, whether it's in the world of politics, through the situation in Ukraine, whether it's their actions in Syria, where the Western nations will say that they're not bombing terrorist targets. And now in sports, where they say that, you know, there's been essentially that they've been cheating all along.
Yeah, but Charles, after staking so much on the Winter Olympics last year in Sochi and burnishing Russia's past Olympic achievements, I mean, what could this news do to Putin?
Well, I don't know that it'll do anything to Putin, but certainly it's a knock. You know, Putin is so closely aligned with Russia's sporting achievements over the past several years. I mean, you think about the fact that he personally got involved and helped secure some of these major sporting events. You point out the Olympics in Sochi. He went also and stumped for the World Cup as well, even speaking in English, which kind of really surprised people in a public format. And if you even look at what he achieved, there was a lot of hand-wringing and sort of heads rolling in the sporting world after the Russians didn't fare so well in the Vancouver Games, and they engineered this sort of remarkable turnaround in Sochi. They came in number one in the medal count. So, you know, he sort of cloaked himself in the success, and it's become symbolic of Russia's resurgence in many ways.
I mean, no one's saying this is going to happen, but what would be the blowback if Russia is banned from track and field events in the next Olympics?
Well, I mean, you know, who's to say? I think it's clear that they have a big choice ahead of them, because this water report essentially recommends that the Athletic Federation here be suspended and athletes be banned from competition until the country cleans up its act on doping. You know, essentially, they've given the International Association for Athletics Federations has given the Russians until the end of the week to come up with some kind of response. You would think that that would mean that either they would propose some kind of reforms if they're feeling sort of if they want to work with them, or they continue to reject the findings, then I think they risk suspension. So, you know, there's not a really good choice here, and certainly time is really short for the Russians. Time is not on their side.
Reporter Charles Maines speaking with me from Moscow. Thanks as always, Charles.
Thank you.
So what if Russian athletes implicated in the scandal were stripped of their recent medals? That would mean other athletes might get bumped up the medal table. That would include American high jumper Eric Kennard Jr. He won a silver at the London Olympics in 2012, just behind Russia's Ivan Ukhov. Eric joins me now from Kansas. Thanks for taking a break from training. I know you were out earlier today. You tweeted, Eric, that you highly doubt Russia is banned from anything. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, essentially, I mean, from what I've read, this is something, and from what I know in my experience as an athlete, this is something, you know, that people have alleged has been going on for years, something that has been institutionalized by their government and their, you know, doping agency for a while now. So without any hard proof, honestly, I doubt anything is going to take place. It will be great, you know, if the guys who are cheating and gals who are cheating are caught and something happens to the country for allowing this, you know, type of deception to take place. But in all actuality and reality, I'm not sure that anything will come of it.
So you're skeptical that you'll get that Olympic gold for your win in London?
Yeah, I mean, the reality of the situation is, even if I get the Olympic gold, I was still stripped of the moment. You know, I took silver in 2012 in London at the age of 21 as a college junior. Imagine how drastically my life would have changed, you know, if I, in fact, would have been a gold medalist, you know, at the age of 21, financially, and just, you know, I won't be able to go back to the podium and, you know, do a victory lap, and, you know, everything's changed.
Right. Nothing's been proven against Ivan Ukhov specifically, but from the World Anti-Doping Agency report, it looks like all the members of Russia's national team were pressured into cheating. You said you didn't know that was the case. We just found out. But at the time, 2012, did you have any idea your competitors might be cheating?
I mean, I know that cheating in the sport exists. I made my first senior team in 2011, a year before in Daegu. And I know cheating exists. I mean, anytime that you're dealing with a sport that requires technique and also, you know, strength, and, you know, you have a year where a guy does X and then the guy comes back and doesn't do what he's done, is not able to repeat. You know what I mean? Whenever you have fluctuations in performance or something like that, that is essentially talent and training based, you always kind of raise an eyebrow and bat an eye, because track and field is about consistency.
Do you think Russia should be banned from track and field events?
I think that, I mean, if these allegations prove to be true, I think something should happen. I mean, I've witnessed guys walk past drug testing, and I'm not dropping any names, and I'm not, you know, pointing any fingers at any countries, but I've witnessed guys say no and just keep walking, and I've, you know,
Like the International Olympic Committee says, or some doping agency says, you need to be tested, and the athletes say just refuse.
It's like, no, and just keeps walking. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't speak English. And just, you know, what do you do? What do you do as, you know, as American? If you're an American doping agent, or you're an American, you know, working for the World Anti-Doping Agency, and you're trying to test an individual and he just says no and walks away, you know, what do you do?
Well, I mean, shouldn't the authority essentially say, no, you can't walk out onto the track if you haven't taken the doping test?
It should, but, you know, if that was taking place, we wouldn't be having this conversation that we're having right now on the phone. Would we?
So fair enough.
If those things were taking place, you know, we wouldn't even be talking about this. So
Eric, what are you training for right now?
I mean, obviously, you know, we have the Rio 2016 Olympics, you know, coming up, but I've just been focusing on my process as far as the season is concerned.
One event at a time. Olympic high jumper Eric Kennard Jr., good luck, and be looking for you on the podium next summer.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I've heard stories about thieves making off with fine wine in Italy, maple syrup in Canada, but the story I'm about to share with you is about a heist of cheese in France. Thieves there recently robbed a dairy farm near the Swiss border. No one was harmed, but the thieves made off with a lot of very pricey cheese, 100 wheels of Comté, to be precise. Police are investigating. Reporter Ulla Majoub is also on the case. She's a food writer with the magazine L'Express in Paris. Tell us, Ulla, how this cheese heist went down.
Well, the cheese heist happened in a village called Goulet-Usier. It's in Franche-Comté, which is an area that's near the Swiss border.
Franche-Comté, also the source of the name for Comté the cheese?
Exactly.
So it's not funny to cheese lovers, especially Comté lovers, but the puns are flying fast and furious. One person tweeted, it's unbelievable. So you're French. Do you think this story is a funny story?
Well, in a way, it sounds like, you know, like a joke, because, I mean, they came at night, they broke into the dairy, they used a simple crowbar to steal the 4 tons of cheese. And
just to get the door open.
Yes. And you think about a heist, you think, you know, a jewelry heist or a bank robbery, but you don't think about cheese. Actually, it makes sense. Cheese does cost a lot of money. And there is a proper market for it, and cheese is not cheap.
What is the street value of 100 wheels of Comté?
Well, it's actually over 44,000 euros, which is about $45,000.
Wow.
It all depends on how old it is and, well, when it was made.
So Comté, as I know it, it's a heavy cheese. I would think moving 100 wheels of it in the middle of the night without waking anyone up, is this an inside job?
I mean, we're talking about a village that has about 730 inhabitants. So we're talking a very tiny village. And the dairy is on the outskirts of the village. So it's in the middle of nowhere. There are only fields around the dairy. So, of course, if someone comes at night, well, no one will notice.
Very hard to imagine how this all happened. Do police have any promising leads?
Well, so far they're thinking about, well, what anyone would think of, that is the black market. There is a black market for cheese. The thing is, there's a control designation of origin on the Comté. So there's a plate on each cheese, on each wheel, with a serial number on it. But the thing is, they'd have to find those wheels. And we must not forget that Christmas is coming up, and Christmas, well, farmers' markets are coming up too. So they could just as well sell them to the common people. And in slices.
Is this the moment where French cheesemakers are going to start microchipping their wheels of cheese?
Well, you never know. But apparently there's already been two heists in that area within the past 5 years. So, yes, they are thinking of putting cameras up and security systems to protect the cheese.
Tell us what is distinctive about Comté.
It's a very famous cheese in France. So, when it's young, it's quite nice and fruity. And the older it gets more nutty and a bit stronger, a bit like Parmesan. Mm. People like it because it does have a distinct taste. And you can use it in, I don't know, in tarts or in cakes, or you can use it in just as grated cheese on top of your pasta.
So for people who can't find their Comté for a while these 100 wheels are out wandering the French countryside somewhere, is like Gruyère a good replacement?
Of course, the people who love Comté will tell you Gruyère is not the same thing. You've got Abondance, you've got Emmental, which is also a very famous cheese in France. Mm. You've also got Beaufort, but I think people will still buy Comté because, of course, there's more than one dairy in France, in Franche-Comté at least. So I think we'll be okay as far as Comté is concerned. We'll find some.
Ulla Majoub, a food writer, and at least for this story, now a crime writer for L'Express in Paris. Ulla, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
A young undocumented immigrant tells us why she hopes the Supreme Court will side with President Obama. That's coming right up here on The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like genetics, graphic design, and golf. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Looks like President Obama will have one less accomplishment to point to when he leaves office. That's because his plan to protect as many as 5 million undocumented immigrants from deportation has been squashed for now. The plan was rejected this week by a federal appeals court, which upheld a previous ruling against it from a federal judge in Texas. The Obama administration says it will appeal to the Supreme Court, but that could push the case beyond the last day of Obama's term. If it's implemented, the plan would defer deportation for a select group of immigrants, including parents whose kids are U.S. citizens and those who were brought here illegally as children. Grisa Martinez is with an immigration advocacy group called United We Dream, and she personally has a lot at stake.
I'm undocumented. I came to this country in my mother's arms when I was 8 months old. My mom and my dad built a home for me in Dallas, Texas, where I grew up as an undocumented student. My mom still is scared about driving down the street to go pick up milk from the grocery store. She's scared about driving to go visit my sisters in college. And she still doesn't know what day she'll be able to go back to Mexico and hug her mother while being able to come back home. And so for me, this is deeply personal. It's the fact that she's not protected from deportation is something that keeps me up at night.
So did you tell your mother, whom, as you said, is also undocumented, did you tell her the news about the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decision, and how did she react?
You know, I woke up this morning. The first thing I did, I called her up. And, you know, in the beginning, she was a little bit confused. She didn't know what this meant for us. But that the one thing that she should know is that we have a fighting chance and we could go to the Supreme Court. She just started crying on the phone and saying, you know, I know this isn't the end, but I can feel hope again. And I know that my story happened today all over the country where other undocumented immigrant youth had the same conversation with their parents.
And why do you think the Supreme Court will support your side?
We believe that President Obama's announcement of executive action stands on firm legal ground. He took similar action to protect people like myself, young people that came to this country and lived here as undocumented. And we believe that this is a constitutional right given to presidents.
Grisa, I'm curious how you identify yourself. American without papers? What word, what lexicon do you use?
Oh, yeah. This is the big millennial question. Like, what is your identity? For me, I think I am the daughter of Elia Rosas, and I'm an American. You know, I think in the beginning of our movement, there was a lot of fear and people living in the shadows. But I think because of the work that United We Dream has done, I know now that I'm not defined by policy. I'm not defined by laws or what, you know, Republicans call me. I am a representation of young people in this country that believe that we can do better and that we deserve better. And so now it's a badge of honor to call myself undocumented.
You know, the point that I would imagine some of the Republican candidates at the debate tonight will be making is that what is so special about the people who claim they should be here? Can you make the case for us why you as an undocumented immigrant should remain in the United States?
All the talking points they have been driving all along are not grounded in what the American public want and have repeatedly expressed. Two is that they also have been racist and hate-filled comments. And so for us and for what we're looking forward to tonight and the work that we do is to be able to uplift the voices of real families. Like, my family has dinner on Sunday nights and we go out to each other's soccer games and are each other's graduations. And so we don't have to prove ourselves as human to the Republicans or to anyone else. We're just doing the work to ensure that the laws protect us as such.
26-year-old Grisa Martinez is undocumented and with the youth-led immigration activist group United We Dream. Grisa, thank you very much for your thoughts today.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Let's check in now with the many immigrants who are hoping to start new lives in Germany. Some 800,000 people have sought asylum in Germany this year, part of the massive influx of migrants and refugees into Europe. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has led the way in welcoming the newcomers, but many local communities are overwhelmed by their new residents. My BBC colleague Jenny Hill visited Oberhausen, a town in northwest Germany, to find out more.
A towering grey stone church stands at one end of Oberhausen's high street. Shoppers clutching their bags hurry past its steps and barely look at the dark-haired young woman arranging clothes and shoes on trestle tables. Michaela's a charity worker. There's deprivation here, she tells me. There's unemployment and there's uncertainty. How will the influx of refugees change this town?
Of course, concern is growing. Already you can feel and hear it. There's a lot of fear among people who are already disadvantaged.
Just I think about Syria, especially, because, you know...
Across town, in the converted school, which is now his home, we met Ayhan. He arrived from Syria weeks ago and now lives in this old classroom with 12 other people.
Actually, it's kind of mixed of emotions, because I feel regret that I left my country. And I am feeling happy that my parents is okay. I'm just, you know, dreaming that Syria, the war would be end, and I go back to my country and build it again.
Outside in the playground, a woman in a headscarf holds her baby close. A little boy trundles past on a donated bicycle. This is supposed to be a temporary shelter. But there's nowhere else for these people to go. There are 2,500 refugees living in Oberhausen. And as Jörg Fischer from the Red Cross tells me, the town is running out of room.
Too many people in two small rooms. We have 12 persons per room, actually, now. We have to mix the nationalities. People are wondering how the procedure will continue, and we cannot answer these questions.
Is there a lot of tension?
I think tension is rising. The longer they stay here, the more the tension is rising. Sure.
Concerns growing too across Germany. Support for Angela Merkel's refugee policy is waning. And Oberhausen is social democrat country. Mrs. Merkel's conservatives aren't popular here.
Guten Morgen, ihr Chaoten.
Einen schönen guten Morgen zusammen.
Most agree integration is key. And it begins here in the classroom. These days, Oberhausen's schools have new children to teach. Svenja Bayer runs a so-called welcome class for refugee children.
It's very important to teach the children about their social environment. They come from very different cultural backgrounds, very different from German culture. It's not just about teaching them to read and write. We want to help them to integrate and for the children to learn about our country and our customs.
In some respects, Oberhausen typifies the German response to the refugee crisis. Broadly speaking, people want to help, but they're concerned about this country's ability to cope with such high numbers. These are the people Angela Merkel must convince when she says Germany can do it.
And that was my BBC colleague Jenny Hill reporting there from Oberhausen in northwest Germany. Coming up, an imam who advises his followers in Britain about sex. Stay tuned for that here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Legendary pianist and songwriter Alain Toussaint loved to circle the globe, and he was always on the lookout for inspiration.
I collect scraps and wishbones and feathers everywhere I go, and then I come home and try and produce a chicken.
Remembering the late Alain Toussaint, truly a New Orleans original, coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Soundworks.org, where you can find podcasts from PRI's The World, including The World's Daily Podcast and The World in Words with Patrick Cox, exploring language in all its glorious complexity. Subscribe at Soundworks.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The votes are still being counted in Myanmar, but it still looks like Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy will be the big winner. And Burma's military-backed ruling party appears set for an overwhelming defeat. As dramatic as the outcome is framing up to be, some Burmese will tell you that Election Day itself was pretty calm.
I didn't know what to expect because I've never voted before. But as soon as I woke up, I lived close to a polling station, and there were long lines, and some people were chatting, some people were laughing, some were very quiet. You know, first impression was that it was very peaceful and serene.
That's Burmese filmmaker Lamin U. He says he picked up his camera and started filming right out of the window of his apartment in Yangon. You may have heard of Lamin U before. President Obama mentioned him last year while addressing a crowd of students in Burma.
Lamin U uses his power to tell the story of his fellow Burmese. He studied at Gettysburg College in the United States. The transformation that he watched unfold through Facebook inspired him to return home and make an award-winning documentary about the plight of Burmese farmers.
Today, I asked a 30-year-old filmmaker in Yangon what or who is inspiring him now.
You know, I think the person who's inspired me the most probably when it comes to my country has to be my father, because he was the one who had the, you know, vision that I needed a good education and that I'm not going to get it here in Burma. He wasn't an educated person himself, but he made sure that I got the best education, which I did in America. And in 2012, while I was abroad in Gettysburg, he was running in the opposition party, NLD, as a candidate in the by-election. And I missed that, actually, because I was abroad. And he won, by the way. He's a member of the parliament now, and he's rerunning now. And this time around, I get to follow him, I get to film him, and I get to see him in action. And he won again. He was reelected this time. I don't think the results are official yet, but we believe that he won landslide. So, yeah, my father will be the inspiration.
Yeah, so he won, as you say. Was he running under Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy?
Yes, he did, and he was personally selected by Aung San Suu Kyi to run for office in 2012, which is still a great honor in our family, even though my mom was very reluctant because, you know, of the nature of politicians in the country. It's, you know, it's a dangerous business.
Does your dad think that he and the National League for Democracy will be able to immediately change policy, that they'll be able to lead?
The thing is that, you know, our country have a lot of problems. Decades of oppression that has kind of ruined the country. I think, you know, the metaphor is that the country is pretty sick for a long time, and you're not going to cure a sick patient right away. I believe the NLD is going to take, and I hope that they will take, the steps to, you know, put the country on the road to recovery. I don't think any kind of change is going to come quick. You know, I've been around the country as a filmmaker. You know, I've witnessed a lot of poverty across the country in all different regions. There are problems about basic education. There are problems about basic health needs. You know, these are very fundamental needs that needs to be fulfilled, and we need better infrastructure in all these areas. It's going to take time. You know, I don't think I voted for the first time, but I don't think I voted for myself. I think I voted for the next generation. Maybe my kids, my niece, their generation, they're going to benefit from the vote that we had on November 8th.
30-year-old filmmaker Lamin U speaking with me from Yangon in Burma. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
10 years ago in Jordan, Nadia al-Alami and Ashraf al-Akras were preparing to get married. Their wedding day was supposed to be the happiest of their lives, but then something unimaginable happened. Their ceremony was targeted by two suicide bombers. 27 people, including many of their closest family and friends, were killed. Al-Qaeda in Iraq claimed responsibility. On the same day, my BBC colleague Caroline Hawley was also caught up in a nearby bombing, and Caroline joins me now. So just take us back to that night in Jordan, Caroline, if you would. What do you remember?
Well, I remember being in the Hyatt Hotel, just being about to start eating dinner when there was a huge explosion. I turned around and I saw a fireball coming down the stairwell. What we didn't realise was that just a few hundred metres up the road in the Radisson Hotel, Nadia and Ashraf's wedding had actually been targeted. We know it had been targeted because when I spoke to them, they said that video of a previous wedding had showed that this husband and wife team who targeted their wedding had been seen in that video. So their wedding was specifically targeted and just, as you said, an unimaginable experience for them. They were about to process into the ballroom where all their guests, more than 200 guests, had gathered when the bomb went off. And it was only one bomb because the bomb of the female suicide bomber failed to go off.
Yeah, so this was a night of multiple suicide bombings, right, in the Jordanian capital.
That's right. There were three near simultaneous bombings, the Hyatt Hotel, the Radisson Hotel, where Nadia and Ashraf were having their wedding, and then the Days Inn Hotel as well. And a real shock to Jordanians, although not a surprise, because Jordan being allied with the West and all that was going on in Iraq, I think people weren't surprised, but they were shocked because Jordan had been stable, pretty much, and it had prided itself on its security, and its security forces are strong and its intelligence services are strong. So it was a real shock. But I think most shocking of all was that a wedding party was targeted by a husband and wife suicide team.
And it was in the wake of those bombings back in 2005 that you met the couple, Nadia and Ashraf. I can only imagine how they were reeling in the days after this. Can you just tell us what they told you about the evening?
They were reeling, but they were incredibly strong as well. And I think that's what surprised me the most, because I was still shaken by my experience in the Hyatt, which was absolutely nothing. It really paled into insignificance compared to what they'd been through. But Nadia said to me, I wanted a wedding to remember, and I got that in completely the wrong way. Mm-hmm. They talked about everything being white, turning red with blood. But what Ashraf said to me, because I couldn't understand how you could cope with the fact that you'd invited people to your wedding and they never went home. And it was Ashraf who said to me, God chose that night the people he wanted by his side. And I think that is how they have coped with it, really, their faith and this sense that it was written, it's their destiny, and that there was nothing they could do about it.
You went back to see them 10 years later. What were you hoping to find out and what did you find out?
I wanted to find out how they'd coped, how they dealt with it, how they'd moved on. Nadia had seen her father die in front of her. Ashraf's father was also killed. Nadia's mother died a very horrific death just a few days later. Her spinal cord had been severed. But what I found is that they now have two children, a little girl called Hala, named after Nadia's dead mother, and a little boy called Khalid, named after Ashraf's dead father. And they talked about moving on and surviving and how they've survived and how they want to be seen as survivors, not victims. Nadia said to me, I'm a survivor and I'm still surviving every day, which really hinted very strongly at the pain they live with every day, but they are determined to give their kids as normal a life as possible.
Did they talk at all with you about how eventually they will tell their children what happened and how to tell that and when to do it?
They did talk about that. They said that Khalid, their little boy, who is 4, doesn't yet know, but that they had told Hala, the 8-year-old, because she'd started asking questions. What was their wedding day like? Questions about the grandparents. Questions as well about why they get stopped on the street, because they became, in a way, celebrities of tragedy in Jordan. So they're still stopped on the street and people are incredibly sympathetic, but they want to know how they're doing. So they said that they told Hala, although actually Nadia said to me, I couldn't bring myself to tell Hala, the little girl, so Ashraf told her. But Khalid, the little boy, doesn't yet know. I did wonder whether he would ask questions when we were interviewing and filming with them. But certainly until then, they hadn't told him yet.
Well, it is certainly the couple's strength that comes through in your story, Caroline. My BBC colleague, Caroline Hawley, speaking with me from London. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Our next story is also about how faith can help guide people in their everyday lives, but it's also about how difficult it can be sometimes to follow traditional religious teachings in our modern world. In Britain, some observant Muslims feel torn between what they believe are Islamic teachings on sex and the values of the West. My colleague, the BBC's Mobeen Azhar, has been following one imam who believes that he can help with that conflict. Mobeen, tell us about Imam Ali Eskarmani. He's both an imam and a psychologist?
Absolutely. He's got a background in psychology, but he has been leading prayers and he's been an imam for 20 years now. So he's someone that's very rooted and grounded in the community. I followed him for a week. I even went to Friday prayers with him and watched his sermon. But he really navigates these two worlds using his background in psychology and his background in the Muslim community. And he emphasizes what he says is a very Islamic principle, even when it comes to sex. And that principle is, he says, the preservation of well-being.
The general principle on the subject is this, that everything is permissible unless made explicitly impermissible. Everything is halal unless made explicitly haram. That means every position, every kind of style, every technique is allowed except that which is made impermissible. Everything outside of that is allowed.
When he says position, Mobeen, is he talking about sexual positions?
Absolutely. And this is why a lot of the advice that he gives could be deemed as somewhat surprising. So you've got to imagine that many members of his congregation, and in fact, many Muslims in the UK, and going further than that, many Muslims from across the world, contact this imam for specific advice on sex and sexuality and the permissibility of things like sexual positions, etc., etc. And so he will take this basic principle of preserving well-being and then use Quranic and Hadith references. So Hadith are the stories of the Prophet Muhammad. And he will take these texts and formulate rulings. You could say these are Sharia-compliant rulings on sex.
So for observant Muslims, do they accept the advice of an imam who is also qualified in the reasoning of psychological science and who sometimes presents some fairly graphic advice? Is there trust?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a really interesting question because you might think there'd be a huge contradiction there. But actually what I observed in the week that I spent with the imam is his congregation and the people that contact him really trust him. It's trust because all of the rulings that he presents are rooted in the Quran and the Hadith. You know, I'll be quite specific. One couple that he worked with, let's call them Asif and Uzma, they spoke to him about the fact that in their relationship, they hadn't been sexually satisfying each other for 25 years, for the entire duration of their marriage. And he referenced the Hadith. He said that the Prophet Muhammad used to approach his wife with a lot of love and care and attention. He said the Prophet Muhammad was famous for kissing his wife in the middle of the forehead. And he even said the Prophet Muhammad would recommend things like foreplay. You might think this is really, really surprising stuff. But because the Prophet Muhammad was mentioned, it was as if this couple were then enabled to do particular things which previously they may have thought of as wrong or immoral or un-Islamic. But all of a sudden, you know, you see it was like a light bulb moment. This couple were happy and they were able to experiment in their own sex lives.
That's fascinating. I'm just wondering what kind of opposition he gets. And I'm especially curious about how new Muslim arrivals in the UK, whose religious leanings are probably much more old school, what they hear when they hear this.
Marco, it's really interesting you should say that because there was some research done recently and it was discovered that 90% of imams in the UK were not born in Britain. That's a problem because overwhelmingly what you have are imams that are not culturally equipped to deal with the needs of their congregation. Imam Ali Eskarmani, who I spent a week with, is very different. He was born in Britain. He went to university in Glasgow. He's got a background in psychology. And I think that's precisely the reason that he's able to navigate between these two cultures. Now, in terms of opposition, the imam was quite blunt. He said he is constantly being targeted and shouted down by both sides. So on one side, you have very conservative Muslims who will say, why are you discussing these things? Why are you advising people about sexual pleasure? These are things that are un-Islamic. And then from the other side, there'll be secular, non-religious people. There'll be secular people in Britain who will contact the imam and say, look, this has got nothing to do with religion. Why do these people need specific advice within a religious context? You should abandon the religion. It's not useful. And I think he is really navigating that difficult space between these two things, because the plain fact is many of the people that go to him for advice are not going to feel comfortable going to a standard counselor who doesn't have a grounding in Islamic theology. And so that's why I really think the service that he's providing is very important.
My colleague with the BBC, Mobeen Azhar, great to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco.
The world that made New Orleans is the same world that made Alan Toussaint. That's coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. First, it was Jerusalem that was hit by a burst of violence between Israelis and Palestinians. Now the focus has moved to another ancient city, Hebron, in the West Bank. It's long been a tense place. Now it's even more tense, with violence flaring next to an ancient shrine, the traditional burial place of Abraham for Jews, Ibrahim for Muslims. Daniel Estrin visited the shrine that Israelis and Palestinians share, if you can call it sharing.
Jews call it the Cave of the Patriarchs. Muslims call it the Ibrahimi Mosque. But they all agree on who is buried there. Abraham of the Bible, or Ibrahim as he's called in the Quran. And also Sarah, Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, and Leah. For Jews and for Muslims, this is the tomb of their spiritual patriarchs and matriarchs. The shrine is divided, one side for Muslims, the other side for Jews. Everyone passes through an Israeli military security check. I start on the Muslim side. A mosque attendant reads verses from the Quran in a large carpeted hall. Muslim authorities prevented non-Muslims from entering the shrine for 700 years. But in 1967, Israel captured the West Bank and Jews started holding prayers here, sometimes at the same time as Muslim prayers. In 1994, Baruch Goldstein, an American Jewish settler, walked into this hall and gunned down 29 Muslim worshippers. Munzer Abul Filat is the Muslim authority who oversees the site today.
I was at home. I rushed to the scene and I carried many injured who were soaked in blood.
And ever since, this site has been governed by a strict regime of segregation. Bulletproof walls divide the areas where Muslims and Jews can pray. 10 days every year, Muslims get to take over the Jewish side, and 10 days every year, Jews get to take over the Muslim side. One of those days happened this past weekend, and beforehand, Abul Filat and his attendants rolled up the wall-to-wall prayer mats.
We remove our carpets because we do not want them to get dirty. The Jews come here, they conduct their dances, their celebrations. Also, they're drinking.
Like the Jewish ritual of drinking wine on holidays. Now, the tomb itself is in a cave about 40 feet under the floor. The entrance is on the Muslim side, but the tomb is on the Jewish side. The entrance is sealed. A number of years ago, though, a group of Jews snuck inside. And every morning, the Muslims who run the mosque manage to get close. Abul Filat unlocks the cover to a small manhole about the size of a dinner plate. A man lights a silver candelabra that just barely fits inside and lowers it down the shaft on a long chain down to the underground cave. It's a symbolic gesture of connection. I go around the building to the Jewish side, where I meet Rabbi Mordechai Hellinger. He grew up in Miami and lives here now.
We read in the Torah about Abraham buying this plot of land as a burial place for his family, and this is the first historically documented acquisition of property by a Jew here in the Holy Land. It's the start of it all.
The muezzin recites the Muslim call to prayer, but the microphone is on the Jewish side of the site, so soldiers escort him to the microphone, and when he's done, they quickly usher him back through the bulletproof divider to the Muslim side.
So he goes through five times a day. See, he's walking through now. Going through.
Neither side trusts the other to respect its property, and neither is very happy with how this place is shared.
Muslims do follow the Jewish prophets as well, and they pray to the same God. So if they want to pray,
I'm all for it.
But this whole place should be under a Jewish authority that would set the rules, set the times when Muslims could come.
Correct, because as we see in any place where the Muslims take charge, Jews automatically become third or fourth class citizens, as we see with Temple Mount.
That's the holy site in Jerusalem, revered by Jews and Muslims, but that today is only a Muslim shrine.
Temple Mount is the holiest site in Judaism. Jews are only allowed up there two very small times a day, and we're not allowed to pray there. We're arrested for praying there.
Israel fears that Jewish prayer at the Jerusalem site could spark a holy war. Palestinians fear Israel actually does want to split the site between Jews and Muslims, like at this Hebron shrine. Abul Filat, the Muslim director, told me Jews have no right praying here.
Prophet Ibrahim was never anything but a Muslim. He was not Christian. He was not Jewish. This place is only for the use of Muslims.
Two peoples clinging to the same place, each claiming it as its own. It's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in a nutshell. I left Abul Filat with one final question.
What do you think the prophets who are buried here would think of the situation today if they saw it?
They would cry and cry and weep for the situation that this mosque had reached. If they had weapons, they would kill anybody who attacked and raided this mosque.
These days, this ancient burial site seems to inspire more and more burials. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin, Hebron.
New Orleans, we learned today, is mourning one of its favorite sons, a man I had the great pleasure and honor to meet 2 years ago, songwriter and pianist Alan Toussaint. He died of a heart attack yesterday, shortly after performing in Madrid. Oddly, in 2013, I was at his house on the north side of New Orleans in Lakeview, Mr. Toussaint at his piano, and he was telling me about the cultural souvenirs he brought home from his travels, especially the trips he took after Hurricane Katrina in 2005.
I collect scraps and wishbones and feathers everywhere I go, and then I come home and try and produce a chicken.
If you just look at the globe and see it as this kind of source of sounds, what have you felt strongly associated with?
Well, not just into my music, but there are some musics that has influenced early New Orleans music that had to do with the Caribbean area as well, and even some Latin and some rumbas. Which is some a la Professor Longhand. Even during the British invasion, just use the Beatles. We all live in a yellow submarine. That's a whole new thought. I mean, that is so cool.
It's an especially sad day in New Orleans, I hear. Lots of tears, lots of people remembering Alan Toussaint as a great and charming musician, but also as a neighbor, a friend, a brother. This is his solo track, Tipitina and Me, from the post-Katrina collaboration, Our New Orleans. And so we say goodbye to Mr. Alan Toussaint. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios. I'll see you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence, by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, the Gruber Family Foundation, Lynn and Bruce Dayton, and the Harold Simmons Foundation. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Rose Family Fund. And by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can.
PRI, Public Radio International.